Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Well, Tony, I thought a iconic finish to Sting's career, hyping matches. He's done hyping his own matches if he lives up to his retirement. And at his age, I think it probably is his last match coming up Sunday, unlike a lot of wrestler retirements where they wrestle many more times. And, this felt like a suitable rappel from the rafters, baseball bat, crow sting, late 90s imagery to build up to their match. And they paid off the Ric Flair swerve now, rather than us sitting around for the whole match on Sunday waiting for something with Flair, the likely swerve. Although, who knows? He still might turn on Sting. Tony, what did you think of the show-closing segment?
Yeah, the final segment of the show, I enjoyed it mostly. I agree with you. I think most people would agree. I know I even said on social media last week, I don't really need to see Ric Flair on my television anymore in 2024, but I agree with you. I hope that was the one and only swerve we get. Another swerve would feel very Vince Russo-ish. I hope we don't get something like that on Sunday. Part of me was wondering, Sting was advertised for the final segment, and it was almost like, well, where is he? It took him so long to get out there. It was very 80s-ish in a way that, the baby face makes the big save. But you know what? It's Sting. It worked for what they were trying to accomplish in the final segment. So no real complaints other than, like I said, I agree with you. I just hope that the Ric Flair swerve ends tonight and we don't get anything too out of the blue on Sunday we don't get that Vince Russo type booking where we're going to get, it's a double swerve and he was in cahoots with the Bucks all along. That's my only hope.
I would say based on what appeared to be the beating Ric Flair took, I mean, they'd have to claim they were pulling punches and Flair was wearing a cup, a protective cup. And I mean, Flair's 75 and he's not going to take a serious beating. And so by the nature of that limitation, I guess this could be a swerve and the Bucks can say, we did our best to make it look good, but we didn't really hit you that hard and you did a good job making it seem like we did. And Flair turns on Sting. I mean, because of all the turns on Flair and the fact that they paid it off now rather than on the pay-per-view does leave that window open. So if Flair is at ringside or shows up at ringside on Sunday, I mean, yeah, our antennas will be up. And I'm not as down on it as you are if they do, kind of a double swerve. I mean, In a sense, there's just such a history between Flair and Sting. And setting aside, and it's just the caveat, if you set aside why is Ric Flair, should Ric Flair really be being featured at this point with his conduct and his history, from a pure character, love the art, not the artist storyline, having Sting and Flair involved in one more swerve or turn, would be apropos, I guess, for everything that they've been through. And, This could be the Bucks and Flair lulling Sting into a false sense of security that Sting overcomes one last time. Why pay it off early unless they're planning that, unless they just want Sting and Darby and the Bucks to be the center of attention on Sunday and not have everybody just sitting around waiting for Flair to be involved in the finish, which would have been the case. So, I can see them deciding to do it that way. How about just the way the Bucks acted throughout this show? I wrote my report at pwtorch.com that I thought the first segment with the Bucks on this episode might have been their best in terms of finding their groove with this new act, their new characters. It wasn't like a big segment, but it felt like they're kind of getting into it and feeling it. And then I did kind of like them going to the locker room door, acknowledging the camera, saying, follow us. And then Sting just having a bunch of bats hanging with some special lighting, playing mind games with them. I mean, I think for a final angle, especially with, you know, Sting not being a top-level talker, but being a top-level star in terms of his charisma and his aura, they picked some good things to do to get people excited about their match on Sunday.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. I have liked the evolution of what the Young Bucks have done the past month or so on AEW television. It's starting to work for them, and if it's going to peak and kind of come into its own at the right time, and that time is right now. So I do agree with you. I did enjoy what they're doing. I thought tonight has been the best of those segments backstage so far with them. Finally, flexing that EVP power, which we still don't know to the extent what it is yet. I think we'll get there. I'm hoping we'll get there. If I'm going to nitpick, and it's purely a nitpick,
yeah.
The only thing I would say is the only thing that I thought was funny to me tonight is if the Bucks were looking for Sting, they should have gone to his locker room first. And maybe the segments were a little bit out of order. But like I said, it's purely a nitpick. And other than that, I tend to agree with you that they seem to be hitting their stride, and I'm very interested to see if they can keep this going moving forward. And it's an act that, like I said, it's not something they've done before. It breaks away from the traditional Young Bucks characters. So I'm looking forward to how it goes on after Revolution this Sunday.
My pushback to your nitpick, or my counterpoint, not a pushback, would be they arrive late. We saw them arrive. And they might not have known where Sting's locker room was. And I could imagine, given their demeanor and their attitude, that nobody would be willing to really point them in the right direction. You know, here they are accusing people of not showing up early enough, and then they're just late arriving, acting like punks, calling out Eddie Kingston for not following the dress code and being presentable. Who's going to even tell them where Sting's locker room is? So I can look past that a little bit. I did like the dress code stuff. I mean, so much of the Buck stuff is sort of meta, where it's like, oh, that's a John Laurinaitis joke, and oh, everything is playing to this clubhouse, you know, clubhouse humor, clubhouse references, and all that. That said, a dress code works even if that isn't a reference to John Laurinaitis, you know.
Right.
And I mean, early on with the Bucks, you know, they made fun of wrestlers standing sideways looking at monitors. Like, they do all this stuff to kind of mock WWE's production, and you know, they were going to do, you know, the Vince mustaches and stuff. So they're always doing that stuff. And to me, it's sort of, I roll my eye a little bit at most of it. It's not like a hard eye roll. It's just like, all right, come on. You got a big stage now. Don't do YouTube humor, clubhouse humor. Just you're larger than that. Create your own world and play within it. But telling Eddie Kingston to be more presentable and maybe we need a dress code works even if you have no idea about the controversy Taz had to live through, you know, 20 years ago with Laurinaitis. And so, I thought they were good, and I thought picking on Eddie Kingston's a good way to get heel heat too, since fans, you know, love Eddie.
Yeah, the even funnier part about that is Eddie just had a match. What was he supposed to be wearing? I mean, that did kind of crack me up a little bit. And I agree with you, and some of the stuff you could consider maybe a little bit too cute, but there is, you know, there's a part of me that does enjoy that, and I agree with you. As long as they don't go too deep into that Young Bucks being the elite metaverse, I agree with you. As long as they pick their spots, there's definitely a spot for it. And tonight, it was, like I said, other than my nitpick, which I could have swore they said that they arrived earlier in the day. Maybe I misheard too. Like I said, I might have heard that wrong. But regardless, like I said, I'm also nitpicking, and I did, by and large, enjoy their act tonight, for sure.
You know, they cut to the Young Bucks arriving at the arena, the parking lot, and then they exited their SUV and entered the arena, and Renee Paquette was standing there interviewing them.
Mm-hmm.
And I assumed, and maybe I missed the comment, just for the sake of trying to be factually accurate, I'll admit, I don't know if they were late arriving, but I assumed that she was backstage and the show was going on and that they arrived late. So we'll have to check the tape on that. But either way, you know, it, like you said, not a huge deal.
No.
But if they were arriving mid-show, that would certainly explain why they couldn't find his locker room in time.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, let's pause and introduce ourselves, introduce the show, and then we'll move on to calls and emails and more topics, including the Hangman swerve. We had a couple swerves on this show, payoff, where seeds were planted last week. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, February 28th, 2024. I'm Wade Keller, host of the show. I'm the editor, publisher, and founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly Newsletter. The latest issue just went up for PW Torch VIP members in digital format, both alt text and PDF format. Issue number 1864. You can do the math. It's a weekly newsletter. I've been covering wrestling a long time, putting up a lot of newsletters with cover stories and paper reports and editorials and a variety of writers and news and scoops and all kinds of fun stuff. You can dive into those 1864 back issues as a PW Torch VIP member, dive into our contemporaneous coverage of your favorite eras of pro wrestling, starting in the late 1980s, marching through all the decades since, predating Chris Jericho's time in Mexico early in his career. That's how far back I go. I covered Jericho when he arrived as a rookie. We're about the same age, but I was doing this a little longer than Jericho. Mm-hmm. All these little markers stand out to me these days when I see these retiring wrestlers talk about their rookie year, and it's like years after I started doing the Torch. Mm-hmm. So I had another one of those moments tonight. So besides that, I also oversee and write for our main website, pwtorch.com. Hope you're checking that out. We got live TV and PLE and pay-per-view coverage, including this Sunday. I'll have my report up as AEW Revolution takes place, and also news updates, TV ratings, special editorials, a great team of writers contributing. It's been a staple of the Torch since I started, bringing in different voices with diverse perspectives, and that continues as part of our brand to this day, being very editorial-based. And bringing on a variety of people with different approaches to evaluating and writing about something that is a passion of theirs. And the other voice you hear on the show is one of those people, Tony D'Onofrio. Did I pick one of the two good options there?
You nailed it. You nailed
Yay.
It.
Yay. All right. I was practicing during commercials. Like a couple times. It's like, okay, don't say it the third way that I got wrong. I didn't psych myself out of getting it right. Tony, welcome to the show. Good to have you here on a post-Dynamite post show, or on a Dynamite post show.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. It's the first time I've gotten to join you on the post show as a co-host. I know I did the one call-in from Cleveland, I think, the one night. We've done some SmackDown and I think a Raw post show. So, yeah, looking forward to talking some AEW for a change.
So tell people about your contributions to wrestling websites.
Sure. Yeah, I've been working as a contributor with the Torch since about around 2008 on and off. Did some Ring of Honor hits and misses back in the day, a few editorial columns through the years. In about the last 6 months or so, I've also joined and have been helping out Jason Powell over at ProWrestling.net, which does remind me, in a way, I kind of have a column due for him that I want to get over to him before I go on vacation next week. Like I said, last 15 years or so, been very fortunate to help you guys out over at the Torch, and it's been a blast.
Very good. Yeah, well, check out his writing at ProWrestling.net and PWTorch.com. We also, by the way, speaking of ProWrestling.net, invite you to check out this is the Wade Keller post show. We cover Raw, Dynamite, SmackDown, and sometimes Collision with live post shows. Here on our Red Logo show, you can search Wade Keller on your podcast app and subscribe. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, everywhere that there are podcasts. You'll also see a blue logo pop up. Looks the same, except it says Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast. And that includes yesterday's flagship edition, the Tuesday flagship with Jason Powell, the head honcho over at ProWrestling.net. We talked a lot of AEW. Previewed Revolution, speculated on what was going on with Hangman Page and what might happen tonight, and also talked a lot about The Rock and Roman Reigns and Cody Rhodes and Drew McIntyre and more. We also had a half-hour VIP exclusive after show where we covered a handful of other topics and answered some mailbag questions. That is free and available right now, the main part of the show. Just, again, search PW Torch, subscribe, and download the show. It's like, I think over 2 hours was the free part. And like I said, we still had some stuff to cover, so we did another half hour afterwards. That was just for our VIP members, and you can get information on VIP membership at pwtorch.com/govip. That's pwtorch.com/govip. Lots of ways to sign up through Patreon, directly with your iPhone using your Apple account, or through our main setup, including access to our full library with credit card, debit card, or PayPal. Again, we'll walk you through it and give you more details on all the benefits, an ad-free website, a whole array of podcasts throughout the week, not only new content just for VIP members like The Fix with Todd Martin, Everything with Rich and Wade, which Rich and I recorded earlier today, covering a variety of topics, the Wade Keller hotlines and post-pay-per-view and PLE roundtables and more. But also we put up our 18 years ago, 18th on the pretty much 18th anniversary of the original publication, our earliest podcasts. We've been podcasting over 20 years, and we started a couple years ago putting them up almost daily. So you can march through some of the original post-pay-per-view roundtables and Wade Keller hotlines with backstage news, just juicy details on the rise of John Cena and dress codes and stuff like that back in the day when TNA was the rising alternative to WWE like AEW has been the last few years. And that also includes early Bruce Mitchell audio shows with a good look at history and hard-hitting commentary. And mailbag segments, the real deal with Pat McNeil and more. So go VIP. It's a real mix of content, new and nostalgia, along with access to our website. And you get our new shows like this, the free ones, the Wade Keller Podcast and the Daily Cast. You get versions of them with the ads and plugs removed, all compatible with Apple Podcasts and many other popular podcast apps. No need to enter username or password or go to advanced settings. We've got a really slick setup. You're just a single click away from being able to listen to our shows ad-free, all the VIP shows and the free ones on Apple CarPlay or on your iPhone or, like me, an Android device too. All right. So with all that said, let's give out the phone number and invite you, if you're live streaming the show, to join the conversation. We'd love to hear from our regulars. We'd love to hear from first-time callers also. The number is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 on your keypad. That flags you on our switchboard so that we know that you want to be brought onto the show. 347-215-8558. You can also email us anytime, but especially during the TV shows we cover or during the post shows with your comments and questions. WadeKellerPodcast@gmail.com. WadeKellerPodcast@gmail.com. If you're live streaming the show and don't want to talk to us, you can email us and still be part of the show. All right, with all that business taken care of, let's move on to other topics, and we'll start by letting Larry from Beardstown, Illinois, lead the way. Larry, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind about tonight's Dynamite?
Well, first off, I wanted to start by maybe asking a question. Do you think anyone noticed or remembers history enough when the Young Bucks went into Sting's dressing room and all the bats were hanging? And yeah, it dawned on me about 2 seconds after, watching it. If you're a longtime fan, the last Sting promo on the last Monday Night Show, he's in a room with bats hanging.
I kind of figured there was some symbolism or a callback, and I didn't have that specific memory. So good call, Larry.
Yeah, it was just one of those things I thought I remembered because I remember as a long time fan watching the last Nitro show on the Turner networks, and as soon as I saw that, like I said, 2 seconds later, I was like, I see what they did there. That's kind of a nice throwback. Makes us old wrestling fans feel a little bit appreciated. And if I could, I wanted to ask you guys, while watching the Chris Jericho Atlantis Jr. match, when they went for the Huracanrana outside the ring, did Atlantis just drop Chris, or did Chris just fall on his head? That looked kind of scary to me myself, but I just wanted to ask you guys and see what you thought.
I think he just tucked, and I think he kind of tucked and had to turn his head to the side because, somersaults are a little harder at his age and at this point with all the mileage. But he looked fine afterwards. Tony, did you pick up on anything?
I think you're right. I think he got his head tucked also, but that was my one jump scare for the night, which if they're looking for a new sponsorship, they could probably do a weekly jump scare for AEW and get it sponsored. But yeah, that was my one jump scare for the night as well. But it did look like he did get his head tucked at the last minute there.
Yeah, I like the thought of, I'd like to see AEW like looking for new sponsors, but not necessarily like medical supply
yeah.
outlets, you know, neck braces and slings and things
right.
like that. I think overall the show was good. The Jericho Atlantis match kind of dragged a little bit for me, but I was pretty well entertained mm-hmm. by everything else on it. And I like what I think they're going to be doing with Hangman Page. I think it's time to kind of see what he can do as a bad guy.
Yeah. Tony, I want to delve into obviously the opening segment in the hype for the world title match, the approach they took with a fake injury and all that. Hangman last week was teaming with RVD and Hook. He was officially a babyface. And I guess my only critique, and it's kind of small because the announcers did, you know, act outrage. Oh, he was lying. It was a con. Is it's almost like in their mind they just figured Hangman was a heel for like a month now, because yes, he was kind of being a jerk for a while and had, you know, an edge to him that he hadn't had before. But to me, I guess I wanted the announcers just sell the idea that wait, this isn't the Hangman we knew, and have, you know, and then have another announcer go, well, there's been signs of him having a different attitude in recent weeks, but we didn't want to believe that he could be capable of this. And I felt that aspect was missing from the angle and the commentary. It was sort of like, ah, Hangman's a heel who lied to us. We should have seen the lie coming, or how dare he? But it wasn't just the trick of faking an injury. It was also, this isn't the Hangman that we've seen for years. This is a very different, you know, this is a very heelish move on his part. And so I felt like they missed that aspect of telling the story. Tony, what stood out to you? What do you think of that? And that critique, and in general, what do you think about the week-long story they told with the swerve with the ankle?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up, because last week felt like there was a deviation from Hangman's story. Last week he was very much a babyface. He played it to the crowd. I can't remember where I heard it. It was a good theory that, you know, because they were in Oklahoma last week, that's cowboy country, that he wasn't going to, you know, get heat as a heel there. Maybe that's why that was done. But yeah, but for the better part of the last month, Hangman has shown heel tendencies. And in my opinion, especially the last match that he had with Swerve, that was the heel turn, with the exception of last week. So I'm glad they kind of went back to that this week. I think it's time to see what Hangman can do as a heel. I think some of the early stuff we saw with him 2, 3, 4 weeks ago was promising. And like I said, it's time to see what he can do as a heel. My only worry is that I think he somehow ends up circling back around and back with the Young Bucks, because now that all three of them are heels, the
mm-hmm.
temptation will be to throw them back together as a group. But I don't mind if they're loosely aligned, you know, back as the Elite, as long as, you know, Hangman is basically on his own as a solo. I don't want to see him in trios matches all the time. But I really do want to see what Hangman can do as a heel. And I think he could do good work if the first few weeks of that turn, with the exception of, like I said, last week's kind of off course, now they're back on course with that. I'm very excited to see where they could go with that. And Hangman showed that, you know, he could pull that off early on a couple weeks ago. And I just want to see where it goes from here.
Larry, I'll throw back to you for any follow-up, anything that Tony or I had to say.
I like I said, excuse me, I'm kind of curious to see what they can do with Hangman, you know, just go ahead and completely turning him. And one more thing I might like to add on the show is I think, me personally, they could have held off what they did with Flair until Revolution. But other than that, I thought that part of it was pretty sound. Would you guys have, I mean, if you two were in charge, would you have went ahead and done what they did with him tonight, or would you have held that off until Revolution?
I think you have to let people know what's going on a pay-per-view before they order it. And this was the right time to do it. What do you think, Tony?
Yeah, like I said, I hope they're not going to get too cute. I don't think they will. I think this was the right moment to do it, because seemingly that's going to be your main event on Sunday. You know, that's one of the few times I think we'll get a non-singles world title match in the main event of a AEW pay-per-view, and you don't want to go over the top cute with it. I think you want, you know, both sides set in stone. And so I agree. If they get too cute with the main event and Sting's last match, I think it would be kind of seen as an overbooked mess, and I don't want to see that. I think the way things, the battle lines are drawn now, I hope it stays that way, and looking forward to seeing that match on Sunday.
Larry, anything else you want to bring up from that segment or anything else?
No, just thanks for taking my call. I'm looking forward to listening to the rest of the show. Always tuck your heads, kids, when you're kind of losing your balance on that shoe and Conrana. And so long from the land of Lincoln.
Thanks, Larry. Appreciate it. Tony, what did you think of Swerve? You know, we talked about Hangman for the most part, but what have you thought of Swerve's journey as a character? And what did you think of tonight's chapter in that evolution, including notably bringing up his history of maybe crossing a line sometimes and kind of laughing at that and the fans laughing with him?
You know, since World's End, I feel like he's lost a little bit of steam. I still think he's over with the crowd. I don't know that this world title feud being a triple threat has done him a lot, even though there is the natural rivalry that he now has with Hangman Page. I did like that he leaned into that tonight because that was his way of saying, yeah, you know what? You know, I've done some unsavory things, but, you know, you guys, everyone seems to be coming around on me and coming around and he's kind of leaning into that babyface thing. And I hope that means we're not going to lose that edge that he does have, you know, with this babyface turn. And I think I was on record late last year, and I think a lot of people were, that this could be the year of Swerve in AEW. Whether that means he gets the title this Sunday or they can hold off until Double or Nothing, that's yet to be seen. But like I said, I don't feel like he's quite as over as he was just 2-3 months ago. But I'm still optimistic about where he's headed right now.
Yeah, I think he's still a work in progress as a babyface character, but I think that's to be understood, and it's not going to just instantly be polished, I guess, as he's trying to figure out how to keep that edge that made him popular, but also not be a guy invading people's homes and beating up 18-year-olds in their gyms. Yeah, there's a challenge there, and it is part of why I'm not just convinced he's the guy that they should go with. You can't fight the headwind of fans cheering him, but you don't want to ruin it by having him lose aspects of his act that they liked. You also can't have Prince Nana being a manager of some heel wrestlers acting like a heel, and then being right. the adorable cheerleader sidekick doing the silly dance. Also, the AEW's got to kind of figure that out sooner than later also. But I think he's come a good ways already on the microphone and in terms of his presence. I do. And I think part of what's going to make him work as a main eventer is believing that he's a main eventer. And I think part of him does. And I think fans like are into that, but you don't want to second guess yourself when you're out there. Like, as he gets more of a push and more and featured more in that top spot, people are going to judge him differently. He's not, you know, it's like being the backup quarterback on a football team. Everything's here. The best of you, you know, came in for a few plays and looked good. And it's not until you play 3 games that people really know if you're good. And if you're not, they start turning on you. And there's that possibility that happens. So anyway, that's my thoughts on Swerve. I thought Joe was the star on the microphone. I mean, Swerve was good. I don't have a problem with what he did. Inflection-wise and how he carried himself. I think he's coming along. Although I will say before I shift to Joe, I would have left out the part about how he was once a cruiserweight. This absolutely would have scratched that from the talking points.
Mm-hmm.
He should – that is so stigmatized as a prelim division. I don't think anybody's thinking about him as being smaller than Hangman Page or Kenny Omega or John Moxley or whomever. You know, like, they don't think of them that way. And he's about their size. So stop talking about that. Like, aware that is a prelim. And I'm disappointed saying it because I've been an advocate. I coined the phrase cruiserweight, and then Mark Madden globbed it and took credit for it. But I globbed it as a way to reframe the junior heavyweight and light heavyweight divisions, which had been stigmatized. I wrote an editorial saying, call it cruiserweight, really amplify the athleticism. But as time has gone on, basically cruiserweights became centerpiece star heavyweights. Bryan Danielson, Adam Cole, Rey Mysterio, the list goes on. So it just, it sort of didn't, we didn't need a separate division anymore because pro wrestling in most places wasn't a dominated by big men anymore. You know, it used to be Don Morocco's and even Tito Santana would, you know, tower over some of the top guys in AEW. If you look back at kind of the 80s Intercontinental title picture. So to me, you just don't bring that up because it sadly has been stigmatized as a prelim thing. So with that point made, Joe was really good on the microphone and just seems like this alpha, confident, badass, where if you beat him, it's going to really count. It's going to really seem like a big deal. What did you think of Joe tonight?
So a few things. First of all, I could tell by your backup quarterback assessment that you're still stung from the Josh Dobbs experiment. And if, as a Steelers fan who, you know, we drafted Josh Dobbs, so I could have told you that was going to happen probably from the start. Great guy, very intelligent. I just knew he wasn't the long-term answer. Having said that, I'll move on to the wrestling because that's why everyone else is really here. In terms of Joe and Hangman, I know I was on record as saying I could have seen Joe after World's End being champion for anywhere from a week to 6 months. And after what he's done the last few months, I don't think it's time to take the title off him. But at the same time, I do want to see them take a chance on someone like Swerve Strickland and kind of run with him. But I don't think it's the time yet. I think they can hold this off until Double or Nothing. We talked about how there's some loose threads still there with Prince Nana and the fact that he is aligned with some guys that are still heels, including Nana being a heel manager. And you can kind of, you know, cut those threads loose before you get back in him back into the main event at Double or Nothing. Having said that, I also saw some unsubstantiated reports today saying that there will be an April pay-per-view. So it could be something where, if that's the case as well, you know, maybe he does not eat the pin this Sunday and you find a way to go with that match in April. I have been very impressed with Samoa Joe the last couple of months. I think he's done a great job as world champion. And it's going to be tough to take the title off him because he does come off as a legit badass. In terms of the cruiserweight verbiage that was used tonight, I agree with you. When he said that and he brought it up, I kind of tilted my head because never in the history of Swerve Strickland, whether, you know, on NXT, especially on national television, I've never thought of Swerve Strickland as a light heavyweight, cruiserweight, middleweight type guy. So yeah, that kind of caught me off guard also. But I was going to ask you, and I know you probably won't make your official prediction until later in the week, but do you think that we see a title change this weekend? If you'd asked me maybe a month ago, 6 weeks ago, I think I would have been leaning more towards yes. But to your point, I think Samoa Joe has just done such a great job with the championship, and it made it seem, you know, like you've got to really put in a tough, badass performance to beat this guy. And I don't know that I would take the title from him that quick, considering how he's kind of cemented himself that way the last 3-4 months.
I am fine with Swerve winning. With the idea being you don't want to miss out on that window. But I'm also okay with him being on the chase more and really hedging a bit if you're Tony Khan. We've got Will Ospreay, maybe Okada. Kenny Omega will probably come back someday. Joe's a good champion. I mean, there's so many options. I think you could actually hedge a bit and go, let's see how Swerve does as a babyface for a while and have him be on the chase. And we can decide based on how he develops and whether we want to go with him. Because what you don't want to do is have Swerve win Sunday, but not have figured out how to be the babyface who keeps his edge. And fans are kind of into Joe. Joe walked out, here, Joe chants. If you take the title from a popular semi-heel tweener champion like Joe, you're taking away some matches that people might look forward to seeing for the world title, so you better be good. And Swerve is good, and fans are into him, but is he as good as Joe? Is he in the league of Will Ospreay? You know, those are
Mm-hmm.
Like, legit questions that are still out there. So if they decide to wait on it, I don't think it's the same as, like, you know, Cody, where, you know, people are like, well, he was so ready last year. And he was, and they could have gone with him, and he would have been totally fine. But Cody's got way more of a proven track record than Swerve, and did even in the lead-up. So my thinking is keep it on Joe. I think they will, but I'm very unsure. But I just think having Joe be a strong, dominant champion, kind of Gunther-like, before losing to, you know, Will Ospreay at Wembley, for instance, makes more sense, because with Swerve as a babyface, who's the heel who's going to take it from him, and do you want to rush it so that you can then have Will Ospreay challenge for it, for instance? So I think there's a lot of moving parts, and then the Okada question, and anybody else that they, you know, want to move into that spot in that mix, Swerve limits it a bit. Hangman, I just don't think they're going to go that route at this point. So I he would be a distant third, but I'm not ruling that out either. If they just want to have Hangman get a cheap win to get the belt off of Joe, but then set up Swerve in a rematch winning the title, or just using Hangman to lose to Will Ospreay in Wembley. I mean, there's a lot. I don't know. There's all kinds of directions they can go. Tony, what do you think of kind of the scenarios I threw out there? My rationale for how I feel. Do you disagree on it? And are there any other scenarios that are in your mind?
So when you started to lay out your scenario of could happen to Swerve if he's given that title too early, the scenario that popped into my mind immediately was I think it was 2008, the 2008 scenario with CM Punk, where he won his first world title when he cashed in on Edge.
Mm-hmm.
And he was world champion for 3 or 4 months, and he wasn't quite ready, and he was being forced as a babyface at the time. And it didn't work, and for 3 or 4 months he was champion. You know, he was holding the title, but he wasn't the top guy. And I could see that happening with the scenario you kind of put in there, where you see Swerve as champion, but then you have Ospreay, and to your point, maybe Okada. Omega's probably coming back. Adam Cole might be back in a few months. Supposedly MJF is rehabbing, and he may be back in the next couple months. And you're looking at a very similar situation like we did back in 2008, where Punk was champion, but the guys headlining the pay-per-views were still Edge and Cena and Batista, guys like that. And it kind of brought me around to your idea of thinking that, you know, while I was on the fence and kind of going back and forth, to me now, you've convinced me. I think Samoa Joe is the way to go, at least for a few more months, and maybe give him that good 6-month title run, have him mow through some more guys. You could even probably, if he continues to carry the title and make it look as credible as it is, you could maybe even hold off all the way until All In to do it. And then maybe Ospreay's the guy to do it there. So, and he's the one that slays that giant. So you got me, you've convinced me with that argument. Because like I said, the argument that came around from here, it just reminded me of CM Punk 2008, where he wasn't ready, whereas a year later he was, even though he had to go back to being a heel. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Very good. We had a couple people on hold. They dropped off. So there's no one in line right now. So maybe we covered their topic. So if you want to get on the show right away, you can. You can push 1 if you're on hold, or you can call 347-215-8558, 347-215-8558, and push 1. In the meantime, we'll go to the mailbag. We definitely have some emails to get to here. I'll start with Zach in Texas. He says, gentlemen, is it 1997? You think this goes on to be a positive or negative comment? Tony.
1997 pertaining to what? Do you mean like how?
Well, it's just his email. Oh, no, yeah. That's the whole point. His email just opens. Is it 1997? Question mark. So is that, is he being snarky or going, yeah?
I guess I you can look at it a couple of different ways, I guess.
Yeah, that's why. I'm putting you on the spot. I'm putting you on the spot. Zach from Texas emails every week, and he's always pro AEW. So it was a trick question in a way. So he follows up by going, hot damn, what a moment and what a final Dynamite appearance for Sting. Seeing him rappel from the rafters one last time, I still have chills. I could have done without Ric Flair, but not even that old perv can ruin this moment. Sting is a superhero, and we got to see him be a superhero one more time. Now, here's Tope, and he goes out on top Sunday. If anyone deserves to retire as champion, it's Sting. And by the way, he writes for PW Torch, and his column earlier talked about how Sting is like his favorite wrestler and as a kid, and he's sad he's retiring. As for the rest of the show, the CMLL guys really need a win. This has been a really lopsided interpromotional battle. Nick Wayne as Dominic Mysterio with actual proficient wrestling talent. There's something to that. While Ospreay being a clear babyface was great. The opening segment did exactly what it needed to do. Hangman is heel, Swerve is really over as a face, and Joe is Joe. Fingers crossed, Swerve walks out of Revolution with a title because, say it with gusto, whose house? Swerve's house. So, Tony, a few comments in there. I'm going to just start with Nick Wayne. He is so good right now. He reminds me of the Lightning Kid in Global Wrestling Federation. We go on to become 1-2-3 Kid and X-Pac, Sean Waltman. He was such a good skinny punk heel wrestler, young wrestler back in, on ESPN during the Joe Pedicino Global Wrestling Federation days. And Nick Wayne is so good at this stage. I mean, I saw Sean Waltman very early in his career. Actually, a little before he was 18, he was working indie shows. And Nick reminds me a lot of him in terms of his heel persona. He is so crisp. He's in the right spot at the right time. Even when he shifts into position, when a move is coming up and you're out of position for it, he does it in a way that's not obvious. Like the little details of what he does between moves and the setup and the timing. And I'm going to pick on Sammy Guevara because I haven't done it in a while. Like, he doesn't like look at the camera and go, hey, look at me in the middle of a fight. He knows he's in a fight to win a match. He's not there to posture for the camera. It's like he gets the business. There's little things that there's an absence of irritants and an abundance of evidence that he was raised in wrestling and gets it. I mean, he had a good reputation coming in, but he's exceeded, I think, even his reputation so far. And was really good tonight. So, Tony, I'll throw to you for thoughts on him.
Yeah, I agree. He was obviously trained properly, and it shows in his ring work. I mean, there's no denying from an in-ring standpoint, you know, the sky's the limit. I mean, he's still only 18. I don't think he turns 19 for another month or two or whatever. But absolutely. When it comes to the comparisons to Dom Mysterio, I would say that, you know, Nick Wayne has to work on the character aspect of that. But again, he's 18 years old. He's got plenty of time. I mean, it took Dom, what, 2 or 3 years to develop a character that the fans could really sink their teeth into. And we've seen that, you know, come to fruition on WWE television. So I don't mind the comparison. You know, he has a ways to go with the character work, but there's, like I said, he's 18. The character work, I feel like, could be developed and, you know, it's just, if he's works with the right guys backstage, he gets the right advice. I mean, I can't imagine that him being put with Christian Cage, you know, to help mentor him, even backstage, I'd imagine. I can't imagine that being a bad thing because Christian Cage, you know, for many years underrated with his character work, and he's doing, you know, he's done his best work from a character standpoint probably in the past 6 months. So to having him with someone like that is only going to benefit him because – from an in-ring standpoint, like I said, sky's limit, and him developing a character, he's got plenty of time for that to happen, and we're going to quite literally watch him grow up on television, and it's going to be really fun to watch, especially when he does find, you know, what it is to connect with to the crowd from a character standpoint.
Zach also brought up Will Ospreay. And saying he was a clear baby face. And I'm glad that they didn't have Will come out and do some sort of like over the top heelish bit before they, you know, he then, you know, something happens where he gets disenchanted with Don Callis. I think it's good to just introduce him tonight or reintroduce him tonight, I guess, but introduce his current character without a big change Sunday. You know, when Don Callis stepped in and said, you know, we did great things, those matches, and starts taking co-credit for what Ospreay achieved in the previous matches in AEW that he listed off. Ospreay, I thought, hit the right note. He wasn't over the top with his acting, but he wasn't so subtle you couldn't pick up on it, but it wasn't in full view of Don Callis, and where it's like, you know, just telegraphing that to Don Callis, if he hears from friends, hey, well, Ospreay's not into you anymore. It was just enough for us to pick up on it, but it to be believable that Don Callis would still think he's got him with him, even come Sunday. And so, yeah, and then, you know, some tension with Takeshita and Ospreay, but that's going to happen even if they, you know, were friends. It doesn't matter that this is telegraphed, that Ospreay's not going to be long for the Don Callis family. Unpredictability is not the number one goal in pro wrestling. It's just telling a good story in a believable way that pulls fans in an immersive way into the story you're telling. And now people are just going to be anticipating seeing Will Ospreay choose to disassociate from Don Callis rather than the other way around. And it's much better if you want to be a top babyface to turn against the heels rather than have the heels dump you. You know, that hurts Seth Rollins, you know, and I don't know that he's like, I don't know that he ever fully recovered from, you know, the momentum we would have had if he dumped the authority instead of them dumping him. So that's my kind of go-to example, but it's happened multiple times, you know, in history where that happened. So I thought this was a good start for Will Ospreay. I thought he was a little bit too goofy with Shivani early on, you know, just his facial expression and stuff. If you want to make an early big-time first impression as – and I keep saying first impression, but a lot of people watching don't know him. But – most people are, you know, aware of him or have seen him do some other work in AEW. So there's, you know, there's that reputation that precedes him and at least some body of work. And obviously a ton of people who go to AEW shows have watched him, you know, on YouTube or New Japan streaming. So that said, the crowd was so into him that he didn't really need to brag too much. The announcers didn't have to talk him up. The crowd was just like, yeah, this guy's a star. But I guess my only nitpick was just that the kind of the goofball face he made when he was moving in for a hug with Shivani. But I also thought it was endearing and the rest of it was good, that I don't think it hurt. But that's just the only thing that like I might have edited out in post-production if I could. Cause I want him to be a cool top tier guy if I'm Tony Khan, not like a goof. And overall he comes across as a star with credibility and confidence and he was likable. And I thought they hit the notes right in terms of his association with Don Callis, where you know it's coming, and Don Callis is just obnoxious enough where you can imagine Ospreay only being able to handle him in small doses, and he, now that he's full-time, he won't be able to deal with him anymore. So, Tony, what did you think?
Yeah, overall, I was happy with the appearance as well. You know, I saw some reactions on social media where it was like, oh, he should have dropped the Kesta right away, and he shouldn't have, you know, he's letting Callis, you know, like you alluded to, take some credit for some things that really he had nothing to do with, because, you know, but boy, then you're just blowing through weeks of TV. Let this breathe. You're going to get to see over the coming weeks, you know, will they let Don Callis continue to subtly take credit for things that he had nothing to do with, and we could watch Will Ospreay slowly get kind of annoyed with Don Callis and his shtick, and then, like I said, you could kind of go from there. But there was no need for him to do that tonight. I liked that he kind of just, you can see it on his face. He was like, when he said, you know, we did this, we did that. And you saw it on Will's face that it was like, it was very subtle, as you said. You could see it in his face, his mannerisms, that like the we part kind of rubbed him the wrong way. But he shook it off. And like I said, let that play out. It's going to breathe. And over the coming weeks, I think we're going to see something develop, because, you know, Ospreay is a big enough star, much like we talked about earlier. I don't want to see him wheel back around into the United Empire, at least not immediately, and that's what I'm hoping, that they don't use that as a crutch. Let Ospreay be on his own for a while, because he's a big enough star that he should be able to shine, and the little bit of the goofy interaction with Shivani at the top, it didn't bug me as much as it bugged you, but I could see what you're saying. I think part of it was just him saying, yeah, I am happy to be here. You know, it's a new start for me, and as long as, like you said, he doesn't lean into that and come across as a goofball going forward, I think I'm willing to let this one slide.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is not it's not like I spend a minute on it, but yeah, I don't think it might actually turn out to be one of his defining traits that works. I just think if you're the new full-time guy and they should have him, you know, they should, in their mind, imagine him being the centerpiece face of this brand. Like, that should be an option that they're not only considering but aiming for. They want him to be their Cody, you know, their guy who everybody loves and you pay to see, and heels come after him. And, I mean, that's what you hope he turns out to be. So everything is, you know, you don't want to micromanage him where he's not himself, and it could turn out part of being himself is that. And like I said, it was kind of charming and endearing, but for a first impression – you don't want anyone in the audience going, I've heard a lot about this guy, and that's him? Like, you want to have some gravitas, I guess, is my point. You want to come across as a star, but you also want to be yourself. So we'll see how it works. You know, he's going to be a fixture on a weekly American national cable show, and he's never really done it to this scale with the type of, you know, being the central figure that he's going to be. So this is new territory. Kenny Omega had moments, but he didn't embrace it. He didn't adjust fully enough to take full advantage of the star he could have been. And don't repeat that. You know, make sure that, unlike, you know, I say it all the time, Kenny, you know, half the time he's on TV, looked like he rolled out of bed and didn't change clothes to get on TV. Just was wearing whatever happened, whatever he wore to the gym or whatever he wore to bed, whatever he wore to go to the kitchen to fry some eggs. Like, carry yourself like a star. And part of that is how you carry yourself. It's how you're dressed. It's how you're presented. Don't follow. Don't make the same mistake like that was made early on with AEW, where the assumption was, everybody knows these are big stars from Japan. We don't need to worry about how we look and dress and the facial expressions we make. Protect him. You know, you don't want him to seem like he's not being himself or he's walking on eggshells. But you just curate a little bit. The people who draw money in this business, people who come across, you know, the top money in this United States environment that AEW is trying to succeed within right now, it's Roman Reigns, it's Cody, it's the people mm-hmm. who, yes, you know, Cody's relatable and he's a wrestling fan. He's not too good to admit that, but you imagine he's living a really cool high-end life. And even the, you know, I went to Barbados for 10 days and it was great. Like, it, you know, he's personable, but he's also, you know, talking about having fun. And so that's good, but put a lot of thought into his personality and his presentation. Decide what parts of him that are authentic you're going to amplify. What are you going to subtract because it's counterproductive? What are you going to add, even if it's not authentically him, because it fits everything else in order to make him a big star? They need to put a lot of thought into that, because successful promoters and top wrestlers do. I knew Steve Austin very well in the 90s. I know how much thought he put into every detail. He seemed authentic. He seemed completely at ease with who he was, but there wasn't anything he did that he didn't put a ton of thought into. I mean, every little detail about how the vest fit, and I mean, he didn't have a lot of gimmickry. It wasn't DDP with layers of stuff, but the walk, the strut, the timing, it felt natural, but it was things he put a lot of thought into, because he knows that's what it takes to be a star. So AEW should aim high with Ospreay.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned Kenny Omega and how he didn't lean into it. And you can even talk about the booking mistakes just from this past year with Jay White, and it's,
I know.
I love Jay White's work. I look back at, you know, the stuff that he did in New Japan, and especially from his promo work. And, you know, I mean, the in-ring work is always there. It speaks for itself. But, man, it's just to see what he's doing right now. And, you know, I hate this bang, bang, scissor gang thing. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not even down on, you know, I know Jason's talked about it, and I know you've talked. I'm not even as much down on the Bullet Club Gold thing. I understand why some would be, because it's like a rehash of time, you know, something from 10 years ago that was super hot. I don't mind that so much, as long as he's being featured properly. But this whole mega group with the Acclaimed and the Bullet Club Gold, and how he's almost you talk about being goofy. Jay White right now is just – and it hurts. It's like, as a wrestling fan and someone that loved his work in New Japan, it kind of hurts my wrestling soul to see what they're doing with Jay White right now. It hurts really bad.
You know what's so telling is when I'm talking to all the top guys that AEW might get behind and want to have world title matches with, and Jay didn't even cross my mind.
Yeah.
Like, that's how far he's fallen. Like,
I'd have never thought that a year ago.
Exactly. Yeah. So that is a more recent example
mm-hmm.
than Kenny Omega. About, you know, yeah. And Jay's got his act down. I mean, the rhythm of how he talks and
mm-hmm.
the cadence of his body language, it's all there to be main event. And he's just a guy. I mean, he's not quite Jeff Jarrett and Satnam Singh and Sanjay with, you know, but I mean, even, I mean, Max Caster, what happened to him? His
mm-hmm.
cool factor went from 10 to like 1.5, and he just seems to embrace, you know, that's, I guess maybe that's a little bit where my thought on Ospreay came in. It's like, don't be a goof.
Yeah.
Like Max Caster's
yeah.
already like lowered his marketability by having that weird crush on MJF with that storyline.
MJF, yeah.
Nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's standing in the background and he's just, I don't know. It's like his soul got replaced with some other soul now, and the cool is gone. And yeah, and so Jay White, another good example. I think, Jay, you can still fix. And I did like Jay White tonight acknowledging that, you know, because people picked up on it, that he wasn't so sure about this group. But I don't know that it helps that now he's saying he is sure, because I don't think anybody else watching is.
I don't believe him. I just,
yeah.
Like I just in previous weeks, sure, tonight he seems a little bit better. But I kind of try to study him just because of the fact that he should be such a huge deal in this company. And they have so many guys that really they could have two split rosters if they wanted to. Different conversation for a different time. But I try to watch him from week to week when he's doing these backstage segments, and I can't imagine. I mean, maybe I'm not a mind reader. I can't imagine he's happy with this. If you'd have told him a year ago you're going to be, you know, in a six-man group with the Guns, that's not so bad. But then you're talking about Billy Gunn and the Acclaimed, and it's going to be kind of like a goofy comedy segment, and you're going to be holding the six-man titles for Ring of Honor. I think he'd have laughed at you and said, "There's not a chance. I'm way too good for that." And whew, it's like a fever dream. I just want it to end.
And, you know, like people talked about Bron Breakker. Oh, call him up. Why aren't they calling him up? And yeah. I'm like, because you don't want to call someone up who you have really high hopes for just because they're ready. You got to call them up when you're ready to give them the big push. And Jay White got put into the world title picture because of, not because that was the master plan, but because they needed someone. And he, in the whole story, what he was just a guy as a placeholder for this other story that was totally MJF-centric. And I heard Jay was not happy at all with how that went. And, you know, I don't want to attach specific words, disenchanted, it's probably overstating it, but a little disgruntled with like, wait, I'm just your utility guy that you threw in, and the whole story is about other people, and I'm going to lose, but I'm going to lose to a guy who can barely walk or what, you know, it's like, it was just terrible. So they got to rebuild him, but yeah, anyway.
Yeah. I don't know if it was brought up at the time. He felt like a placeholder for CM Punk at that time. Punk had that fake world title. So how did they fix that? Jay stole the world title. To me, that was their way of him being a surrogate for Punk in that moment, and I couldn't understand it.
Yep. So many bad things in 2023 regarding MJF. And I always do the cat. I always, you know, it's not an excuse, but it's just factual. A lot of things were not MJF's fault. A lot of just bad luck happened.
Mm-hmm.
But their adjustments to that bad luck, not much went well. All right, we'll go to Jason B., who says, tonight's Dynamite was good so far. He sent this in mid-show. But why have rankings if you're going to have an open challenge? And he also added, I thought Ospreay came off as a big star tonight. He's attending Revolution this weekend, he notes too. So, Jason, that should be fun and settle in, because there's a lot of, you know, good to really good matches on this show. Ospreay came off as a star, but he asked about, the rankings. Remember when we were like, oh, they're bringing the rankings back, and then it seems like they lost interest after a week and a half? I mean, I know I think they've updated them a couple times, but it's not a central part of the show. I mean, WWE's doing more with their silly video game rankings than AEW is with theirs. So it seems like it's something they're going to bring up when it's convenient, but they're not going to abide by it as kind of a central driving force of who gets title shots. And part of that is the challenge of deciding who in the top five gets a shot at which title and why. They have too many titles.
Yeah, I mean, the too many title thing. I think anyone that follows the business enough knows that that's a thing, but we don't even have to go down that avenue right now. The rankings themselves, they seem to be more of a hindrance on the booking than helping, because when you introduce something like that, and if you're going to stick to it, then you have to book around it. And to the point of the email, the open challenges don't make sense. It makes things messy. And when they got rid of them the first time, I understood why. I don't mind them keeping records, but the rankings themselves, they put like a chokehold on your booking. And it's better if they let them fade away again. I wouldn't care.
All right. Up next, Kevin from Colorado says, "Hey, Wayne and Tony, I'm watching the Nick Wayne Orange Cassidy match, and I'm curious if you guys think that Nick Wayne's high flying style could possibly pose a threat to him playing a heel character. I don't catch Dynamite much, and I keep track of everything through the Torch and its coverage. Looking forward to hearing your responses." Thanks, Kevin. I don't think so. I mean, I get it. Like, I think it's been a hindrance to Sammy Guevara, but that's because Sammy didn't know how to play a babyface or a heel. He just was Sammy. Like, he didn't adjust the presentation of his heel moves to make you resent them. He just kept doing high spots to get his spots in. And yeah, I mean, it just obviously there was sort of a lack of self-awareness when, you know, mashing faces with his fiance turned into a repulsive thing for fans. It was just too much, and they were just like, "Why don't you love seeing us make out? We're hot." I mean, it just there were just things that somebody in their late 20s should have known better then. And I'm bashing him a lot here, but I'm not alone in this thought, and it definitely was exhibited in terms of crowd responses. Some bad choices were made there, but he didn't know how to really, really lean into being a heel. And he also, you know, as a babyface, was kind of bland. He didn't know. It's kind of what I talked about with Swerve. You've got to figure out when you go from, because Samuel's a rising star and a pillar for a reason. He's super talented, has, you know, great look, some innate charisma that you can't create. You know, you have to have it. There's a lot there, but there's just some lack of refinement, immaturity to the presentation of the character that cost him when he went babyface. And it just, everything interesting about him just was drained from him when he went babyface. So to me, like, Sammy's a good case study for what not to do, and Sean Waltman is a good case study for what to do. And when you look at X-Pac, when he was with Hall and Nash and DX, he was, you know, the background player, and he had, you know, the X-Pac go away heat, as people called it, but he was that punk who could get away with being kind of like Dominic. You can get away with being brash and more full of yourself than you should, because you're surrounded by bigger, tougher people. And so when Nick Wayne is doing high-flying moves, people are going to pop for him, but he is overriding the crowd's natural tendency to cheer for high-flying moves because he's such a punk. Like, no matter how graceful and quick and athletic he is, he's doing the other parts well enough to override that. It's a challenge Seth Rollins had. Every time he's been a heel, he had, and it goes back to things I know he was told when he was in NXT, which is stop trying to get all your spots in. We're trying to get you over the heel. And he's like, I want to get my spots in. I got my spot. I got to dive through the ropes to ringside. There's that inclination from, you know, a certain generation of wrestlers that that's how you get over and that's how you get social media buzz. But when you're a heel, you've got to augment some of that stuff or be so obnoxious that people resent you despite being exciting. I think, again, Nick Wayne has that instinct, or that pedigree is probably a better way to put it, and is doing it right. So I'm not too worried about that. Really, I'm not at all worried about it based on what I've seen so far. He can be exciting, but he also is taking great bumps. He's a great foil. His facial expressions are coming along. I'm not too worried about it. How about you, Tony?
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. It's more of a self-awareness thing. You mentioned Sammy Guevara, and it's almost like a Seth Rollins syndrome, so to speak, where it's like, you know, when you're a heel, you do have to work a different style. I mentioned it before. He was, you know, he was obviously very well-trained. He knows what he's doing. You even mentioned all the subtleties about how to make things look like it's more realistic, whereas Sammy is looking at the camera. He's playing to the crowd at home. Not to mention, you know, and it's almost like I'm repeating myself, and I don't mean to, but it just kind of fits the what I'm going for here. You know, he's now under the learning tree of Christian Cage, and if there's anyone that knows how to work a style where you're going to be doing some high-flying things and work some high-spot-type matches, it's going to be Christian and still be a heel, because him and Edge did it in the early 2000s. I mean, sure, they got their share of cheers, but those guys were also the heels for most of those feuds. And if anyone can, you know, steer him in the right direction at this point, it's going to be Christian Cage. And I think, you know, we've both kind of put Nick Wayne over big today in the show. And it's for a reason. I don't see him running into that problem. He seems like, to exactly what you said, he's been taught the right way, and he has the proper pedigree that I don't think it's going to happen.
All right, let's go to JB from Detroit next. One, was the Hangman ankle injury at work the entire time, or was it a happy accident that they were conveniently able to use it for his continued heel turn? I think it was work all along, Tony. I haven't, like, confirm that, but I that's just been my understanding, I guess, of it, where I haven't even considered that it was legit.
Yeah, and it's like the last time I was on the post show, like I said, I try to be as well-rounded and pay attention to as many respected wrestling journalists as possible. I know Sean Ross Sapp came out last week and said that he confirmed that Hangman is just that good at his job, that he had so many people convinced he was really injured last week, and I know it became a big thing with Jerry Lynn, and it turned into a mini feud with him and Sean Ross Sapp, where he's like, you shouldn't be reporting this, but when people think he's really injured, you know, that's another debate for another time. But Yeah, apparently this was going to be something where Hangman might have had a personal issue and wasn't maybe going to be able to work the pay-per-view. I think after tonight that question has been answered. But the final answer from Sean Ross Sapp was that Hangman's just that good at his job, much to the way that Randy Orton was this past weekend in the Chamber, where some people thought he ranged his back. If you're that good of a worker, you know, you should be able to get some people to believe that you're really injured. And it's a credit to those guys that when they do try to pull that angle off.
Yeah, I've known Jerry Lynn since the 1980s when he was having standout matches mm-hmm. on the indie scene with Sean Waltman. And I think Jerry Lynn is the has a wider array of wrestlers who've had their best match with Jerry Lynn than just about anybody during his decades in action. I have immense respect for him. But I don't know that the job of a journalist is not to forward storylines or cover up for a company that's pulling a con. So you either need to seal off leaks and sell, have Hangman sell it the whole time, or do a different kind of storyline that's easier to sell, to not have word get out that it's a work. If Sean Ross Sapp heard that he's not really hurt and he didn't report it, that's not doing his job. To me, that's different than giving away the finish of a match or saying this is going to be the match at WrestleMania and doing it a month before the angle plays out. Like, that's just show-off reporting. Hey, guess what I found out? Now I'm going to spoil it for you. But when you do an injury angle, injuries are part of a reporter's job to report on. Wrestling promotions do fake injuries and real injuries. You can't earn the respect of your audience or keep the respect of your audience if you seem like you're in on the work, you're in on the con, that you're hiding information from your readers when they're worried that Hangman might be legit injured. So don't do injury angles and expect it to last a week and expect journalists to be in with you. They're not getting a paycheck from you. That's not their job. It's a different category. I sympathize with Jerry Lynn's frustration, by the way. If you're going to do an angle and you want it to work, and especially because AEW caters to the social media crowd and the internet crowd, you do not want word getting out that takes away the fun, because basically your audience is people, at least the ticket buying public. They're just waiting for a swerve because they're all over social media, because Tony Khan, I think, limits himself by playing mainly to people who are on social media, not as much as Tony, nobody is, but, you know, a lot. So in listening to podcasts like this and going to websites like ours, so I get the frustration. If I'm doing that, if I'm in the position Jerry's in, of course I want things to play out and be surprises. But the way to do that is to seal the borders in-house, not blame a reporter for reporting facts.
Right. And I think you made the point that if you're listening to this show or you're listening to one of Jason's shows on ProWrestling.net or you're subscribing to Sean Ross Sapp's stuff, you're not subscribing to a kayfabe magazine. You're not going to get that. So, I 100% agree with you. Wasn't sure if we were going to dive into that at all, but yeah, I mean, and I all the respect in the world for Jerry Lynn, but I agree with you on basically everything you just said.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's an egregious statement from Jerry Lynn, because he's not a journalist. It's not his.
Mm-hmm. Right.
His area. He's a guy who wants to tell a good story in a wrestling show and is frustrated that word got out. But it is not fair to expect that of Sean Ross Sapp. Now, part of the problem is when you're a reporter who is reliant, it used to be photo access. Like, that was the key for the magazines. The reason they kissed up to every booker and promoter in their writing is because they needed access to ringside photos in order to have the photos they needed to publish magazines and sell them. And when you're reliant upon cooperation from the company for press credentials or getting your question taken on press conferences or getting interviews with wrestlers and not being ostracized and seen as the enemy, you have to check what you report. You don't have to, but there is a motivation to check what you report and play along and not sometimes say publicly what you're saying privately. And there's enough people like that someone in a executive position in wrestling can then come to expect that from everyone, not realizing that everyone isn't just doing this because they're fanboy fangirls who just want access and want to be friends with the wrestlers and the promoters. That's not journalism. It's whatever the term is now, you know, fandom, content creators. I don't know. You know, there's
content
all
content creators. Yeah, that's what I was. Yep.
Well, I know there are content creators, but there's right. content creators who are journalists. So I was adding the prefix yeah. to it, which is the fanboy or fangirl, the fandom based content
right.
creator, the ones who are advocates for what they are talking about or writing about. And mm-hmm. you know, you can do that, and that's fine, but it's not the same category
right.
as being a reporter or a journalist who is willing to risk sources and access to serve their readers primarily. And you know, certainly that's been our approach from the torch from the beginning, and it's cost
right.
us access to certain people who were very friendly with us at one point, and then when they did something controversial and we didn't hold back, you know, they got upset. But that just comes with the territory, and each entity and brand can approach things the way that they want. Okay, number two from JB from Detroit. I'm not sure Swerve mentioning his prior sinister heel acts was the best way to further himself as a babyface on The Chase. I have mixed feelings about this, and I know why JB's saying that, but to me it was sort of the pink elephant in the living room. Like, you know how you acted, and we're just supposed to pretend you didn't do that? I think this was sort of a release valve where he's acknowledging it, and he's saying, yeah, I've been always crossed the line sometimes. And in a way, I mean, yes, they shouldn't have done the angle. And this is an example of why, you know, because it's just invading someone's home. It's just so dumb. I mean, just come on. There's better ways to tell stories in pro wrestling than something that ridiculous and over the top that should lead to you being arrested. And Tony Khan had a bad answer to it when he was asked about it.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't do silly stuff like that. There's so many things that have been done the last 25 years in pro wrestling that should last 30 when things really went off course. It, you know, some Vince's who had influence were part of it, but others too. Just because you saw it as a kid doesn't mean it was a good idea and it should be done, or that it was helpful to the boom period that you watched. There were things that were counterproductive that don't translate to today, and home invasion angles are one of them. And so to me, this was a release valve. It's worth going, yeah, I'm not pretending I didn't do that stuff. I'm owning it. It's part of my character. It's part of my official biography. We're not scrubbing it from my bio. But that's not who I'm going to be, you know, anymore. And I am acknowledging it was crossing a line. I'm going to frame it as here's why I did it. And you didn't imagine it. But, you know, we're going to move on. So to me, I think it, like I said, release valve would be kind of the phrase I'd use for it. Acknowledge it and move on. So,
yeah, like I said earlier, I didn't mind it. I thought it was a nice touch. He leaned into it, said, you know what, I've done some unsavory things. You know, we all do things we may regret. Maybe he didn't regret. He didn't say that. So I actually admire
That's open for us
right.
to project onto him.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Like I said, I'm glad that he didn't say he regretted or didn't regret it, because, you know, that's up to interpretation. And you know what? And as long as he doesn't start going around saying that he's everyone else's scumbag, I think he's going to be fine. And it worked for MJF, don't get me wrong, but
yeah,
still, like,
to a
it,
point, yeah.
I think MJF just went too far into it, and I think that's where, maybe that's what he's concerned with, that, you know, that Swerve's going to do that. But I would be surprised if Swerve even brings it up again. I have no problem with him bringing it up as a one-off to basically, like you said, acknowledge some things from his past and then move on from it. And like I said, as long as he doesn't lean into it and it doesn't become part of his everyday gimmick, I think he's going to be fine.
Number three, Nick Wayne really makes a great slimy heel with a punchable face. The subtlety of his arrogance between moves is not something a lot of wrestlers his age would have. It's really been valuable for him to work under Christian this early in his career. He wrote that before we talked about Nick. I
mm-hmm.
talked about Nick before I read what JB said, but boy, are we all on the same page. It's that
yeah.
there's so many people who are into moves, and this is an awesome chance. And hard slaps to the chest, and they aren't paying attention to what matters as much, if not more, which is what you do between the moves. And the people who elevate their matches and turn into drawing cards and aren't just out for star ratings based on density of high spots are the ones who draw money and succeed. And the fans that notice that, you know, I think can appreciate the art form at a higher level. And that is something that Nick's doing a good job with. He gets it, you know, and you can tell early on if someone's going to get it.
Yeah, nothing really to add. Like, I've said
yep.
it a couple times now that, you know, him being under Christian Cage, it's obvious the, you know, just the respect that I have for Christian Cage as a performer, and to be under someone like that and already be light years ahead of what many performers or what many wrestlers are at age 18, sky's the limit.
Yeah, the Patriarchy and Drew McIntyre are leading pro wrestling right now in outright offensive t-shirts. Number five, he goes, I'm glad that Will Ospreay had his own segment that framed him as a big deal leading into Revolution. He seemed genuinely excited and running through all his accomplishments and beating OC, Omega, and Jericho. That was a nice touch. He definitely has the natural charisma to him on top of being arguably the best in-ring wrestler in the world. Don't know if I have anything to add to it, but JB, we're on the same page on that. Number six, after missing a few weeks, Chris Jericho comes back with a bit of a refresh presentation. Was it noticeable to you, and did it make a difference? I definitely think the match with Atlantis Jr. went way too long. We haven't talked about that much. Tony came out to his old, lion. I don't know. I think it was meant to be this like throwback, because he was wrestling the son of somebody he wrestled early in his career. I don't know. I'm assuming that's not the end of Judas, unless it's been reported it is. So I think it's more of a one-off given the context, and he's done that before. The match went too long. I was actually pretty surprised by it. It was fine. But everyone's waiting around for Sting, so, you can get away with it. What would you think of the Jericho presentation, his promo, his match, how long it went, all that?
The presentation, we've seen him do the Lionheart thing before, whether that's the end of Judas or not. Probably not. I can't see them doing that. That's been such a big part of his presentation for the last 5 years. The match was... Basically, it's exactly what I was going to say. It was fine. It's overstayed. It's welcome. I know they're establishing this relationship with CMLL. I was glad that they at least gave a little bit of background on why we were getting this match. So I do give them points for that. I really do, because a lot of times we go into these matches blind, and I'll be completely blunt. I know very little to nothing about CMLL. It's one of those organizations. Between CMLL and AAA, I don't know that much unless it pops up on the Torch page or the ProWrestling.net page, and that's very few and far between, just because we don't get a lot of access to stuff like that here in the States. But I was happy they gave us background. It looked like Jericho worked most of that match as a heel, though. That's not what he's been doing lately on television. So it just felt so out of place. Besides the obvious thing, like I said, they're trying to form that relationship. And then even the post-match seemed like it was awkwardly dragged on and nothing happened. And I don't know if that's supposed to be a cliffhanger. And I don't know if Jericho's going to get a match against Atlantis Senior next week or in 2 weeks or whatever. But it just felt like it overstayed its welcome and it was just kind of there. And I didn't understand its purpose other than the AEW-CMLL relationship being established to go a little deeper. It was mentioned earlier, eventually these CMLL guys, they got to start getting some wins on AEW television. And I know those the AEW guys are probably going to lose when they go to Mexico, but
right.
you can have those guys win on TV here too, because at this point, I know nothing about most of them with the exception of Atlantis because of today's video. It's sad to say I don't care as much.
It's not sad to say. It's not your job to care about things you don't care about. It's the job of the company to present things to you that you care about, but making you care about them. The idea of AEW being this company that works with all these other companies, and it's like, if you grew up as a kid and, the newsstand magazines would talk about that. Why is WWF have, these walls around themselves? Why won't they let their world champion defend the title outside of it? And, it was sort of like this, it was fine for an editorial perspective, and I got it, and I kind of bought into it as a kid reading it. But realistically, why would they? They're the number one territory. They want to control their stories, and we don't want to have white towels being thrown in to try to avoid a finish. Not that WWF didn't have people come in. It's part of the Cody Dusty, finishing the story thing. But this idea that every company not acknowledging all the other companies is doing something wrong, it's not. There's more than one right way to do it. And having your own ecosystem and staying within it is fine. What AEW is doing is also fine. There's ways to execute both well and both poorly. AEW is doing it poorly a lot of the time because they are playing to an audience that knows everything about everything. Basically, it's a show produced for people with Excalibur's knowledge and passion. And you need to hold people by the hand a little bit more. And as Jason said on the flagship yesterday, don't assign people to look it up on Google. You know, and early on in AEW, I talk about homework. Like, you know, Cody said, you know, Cody Rhodes himself, when he's an EVP in AEW early on, said, we shouldn't assign people homework. People shouldn't have to leave our ecosystem to figure out what's going on when they tune in for 2 hours every week. And the CMLL thing feels like, you know, Tony, a grown-up kid, going, wouldn't it be cool if? And obviously the wrestlers want to do it. They've got their dates and their gigs and all that, but they are serving two masters, and it waters down the finishes and the story. There's no investment in the CMLL wrestlers if you're just the typical AEW viewer, or the AEW viewer that AEW is at risk of losing if they feel alienated or lost. So I don't think it's the way they're doing it is not convincing me it's a good or worthwhile decision, but there's sort of that. The positive is it does feel like when you watch AEW, they're part of this larger wrestling world and all of wrestling history. And it is a way to combat WWE being, you know, a very closed ecosystem and differentiating yourself. But again, there's a better way to go about it so you don't leave people not caring. Excalibur bouncing back and forth between announcing Collision and Revolution matches couldn't have been more confusing. Oh, it's awful.
Yeah.
I'm trying to keep up on typing up the results, and I was just like, okay, the match is being announced, and I just gave up. I mean, and then on Friday, and then you got Shivani saying the countdown shows on Saturday, and they have to correct him and say it's Friday. Easy mistake to make. You're listening to Excalibur. I don't even know what night. I usually know what night Collision and Rampage are on, and as he was talking, I'm like, is Collision changing nights? Is Rampage? It was way too much information thrown at us. There is a really good way graphically and audibly, or verbally, to explain this stuff, and this was a masterclass in how not to do it, Tony.
Yeah, and you're a lot closer to Jason than I am. You need to check on him because he might have had an aneurysm during that segment because I know I love listening to his review of Dynamite. And
yes,
I mean, and they hadn't done, it seems like they were gotten better at this for a long time, but tonight it's like they made up for months of not doing this. And it was one of the most confusing rundowns of future events that I've seen in a very long time, if not wrestling history, with how they were just bouncing back and forth between Rampage, Collision, Revolution, back to Collision, yep, over to Rampage. Yep. And, oh, by the way, this is going to lead to this. And there's two qualifying matches for this, and then that's going to lead to this match. But we're going to go back to Rampage. I was like, is this like an SNL skit? Like an SNL skit.
And Magnus versus Matt Sydal is not a payoff to confuse us. You know what? Just surprise us. Just say tune in to Rampage. Don't be a qualifying match. Don't tell us it's going to be two people that we care nothing about or little about who have been jobbed out. Like, how do you make the augmented scramble match, the all-star scramble? It's not an all-star if Matt Sydal is in it. I'm sorry. Matt Sydal's super talented. I've interviewed him, and he's had his moments for sure and was just one of the most mega-talented people at his peak. But he's not treated as special by AEW. So you got Sydal against Magnus, and you're confusing people, and that's one of the matches that's causing confusion. Just go, there'll be qualifying matches this on Friday and Saturday. Tune in to find out, or check our Twitter feed. And by the way, Tony Khan said because of the injuries of Wardlow, Powerhouse Hobbs, and Lance Archer, we're not going to have the meat. What was it called? The Meat Fest? The Meat?
The
Meat Grinder? No, I forgot. Whatever.
Meat Madness, right?
Meat Madness. Yeah. So we can't have that match. And now the three people who were in that match are in this scramble, right? So what is it? I don't get it.
So between that, I don't know if that means there were additional larger wrestlers that were supposed to be on the show and they couldn't get into the States, or if they're – that's the only thing I could think about. And then, you know, you brought up the Magnus thing, and I mean this wholeheartedly, sincerely. Wait, I missed the Magnus announcement in the midst of the confusion because I was trying to keep up with what was going on. And I saw it on social media like 3 minutes later. And I literally went, Magnus, what? I didn't even know. Like, that was not a name I had on my bingo card for tonight for Dynamite. And I was just like, Magnus, where did that come from? And I'm like, but wait a minute. This guy's going to be in line for a title shot if he wins on. I was like, you got to be kidding me.
And isn't he the GM of SmackDown? Like, I don't know. Just throwing these names, these CMLL names out there. Okay. I think one other point. Okay, JB says, I like the way the Bucks told the cameraman to follow them as they search for Sting. That's kind of attention to detail I like. Tony Khan told me on the eve of the debut of Dynamite on this show, the Wake Keller podcast, the Blue Eagle show, he didn't want to do invisible cameras. Like, he wanted everyone to always be aware cameras were there. And except for, like, Adam Cole, MJF nonsense, and Roderick Strong having Adam Cole at his house as a slave servant, whatever that nonsense was. They've been really good about not doing what WWE's doing, which is so irritating, which is the multiple camera angles where you can tell they filmed it three times and spliced it together because cameras aren't visible on different angles. That's just stupid. And NXT does it, and I just strongly disagree. I think it breaks the immersion of watching, and it's a production technique that should be wiped out of pro wrestling's presentation, at least in the context that AEW, WWE, TNA, and ROH film stuff. So I like that. And Tony's, I think, stuck to it in terms of when you're at the arena, the cameras are visible, and they're not nosy. They're not given free rein. A camera's stationed there for an interview with Renee. WWE overdoes it with, we happen to be filming Adam Pearce looking at his phone for no discernible reason, live on television, but fortunately, every time we do it, something interesting happens, and a wrestler
somebody popped up. It was great,
it's so dumb. It's just, stop it. It's so dumb because you can film it in multiple other ways that make sense, that makes it feel like a roving camera guy. You have Coco, let's go backstage. We hear that. We hear right now that Chelsea Green is approaching Adam Pearce. Let's go catch the action. You could say that. It feels real. It's like, it's more exciting than we come back from a break and there's someone on their phone. It's such a bad, stupid, low IQ trope. They should stop it. What am I ranting about? Oh, yeah, the Bucks. Good for them. Yes. Follow us in here. You're invited to follow us. I agree. I like that attention to detail. I got other
Having said that, did you get PTSD? I mean, you made a good point. Tony Khan's been – they have been good about this, that they invite the cameras instead of them just randomly being there. I'm not going to lie. I got PTSD when they looked into that mirror that we were going to get an Ultimate Warrior type
thing. Oh, yeah. Totally.
I was so scared. And when it didn't happen, I basically exhaled, and I went, "Oh, okay." Funny. But it's so sad that we're conditioned from years and years of that type of stuff that I'm like, "Oh my God, they're going to do the Ultimate Warrior thing with Sting in the mirror. They're going to turn around. Sting's not going to be there, and who's the idiot here, us or them?" And it didn't happen, and I was, and it's crazy that I was so thrilled that didn't happen.
We are so scarred from all our decades watching wrestling. Yeah, I did. I was like, yeah, is there going to be an image of Sting that shows up as Nick looks haplessly at the camera or the mirror? All right, finally, JB says, after the beatdown tonight, there's no way I could see Sting and Darby losing at Revolution. I was more nervous watching Flair take bumps than I was curious. So, I think stuff was fine. All right. We'll go to I haven't checked the phone lines for a while. Sorry, someone called up and left us. Nope, no one is on hold who wants to come on the show. All right, so we'll go to Jason in Grand Rapids. Hi, Wade and Tony. Hope you're doing well. Overall, I enjoyed the show tonight. I'm looking forward to Sunday. Sting has been a favorite of mine since emerging on the scene of Jim Crockett Promotions, NWA, when I was a very young wrestling fan. Been around a long time. It makes me so happy that he's receiving the send-off he has earned and very much deserves. That little run in WWE was just nowhere near the level it should have been, and I felt it disrespected Sting's legacy. I'm sure I'll shed a tear or two on Sunday, and I can't wait to see the reception he gets in Greensboro. So two questions as it relates to Sting riding off into the sunset. What's next for Darby and the tag titles in either win-loss scenario, and what's next for the Bucks in either a win-loss scenario? Thanks for all you do, Wade, and everyone go VIP. P.S. Great to see Will Ospreay officially arrive full-time in AEW. Thank you, Jason in Grand Rapids. Tony, I'll throw to you first. What do you think is next for Darby and the tag titles?
So the Darby question is very interesting because the last, 3 years of his career, he's been so linked to Sting, and now it's going to be – I'm curious to see that myself.
He still can. Sting just won't wrestle.
He still could be. He's been tied to Sting and basically – random TNT title feud for the last 3 years, 3-4 years. So I don't know if he's going to just jump back into something like that. I'd love to see him in a fresh feud. Like I said, they have no shortage of talent. There's no reason to believe he can't be put into something meaningful. So I would like to think that they win on Sunday, and Sting goes out undefeated. But if there's a reason for Tony Khan to ever, you know, do his favorite thing and start another tournament, it would be, you know, it would be them winning so that he could vacate the titles the next weekend. So my belief is I think the right decision would be, honestly, I think the Bucks should win this match. I think it will help further develop these characters. Having said that, Tony Khan loves him a tournament, and I can see them going out on top, and then a week later, those titles get vacated, and we get a tag title tournament.
Yeah, I could see a tag title tournament. I haven't thought of, like, the perfect partner for Darby if, like, and I don't like the idea of Sting and Darby winning and then somebody else becoming, like,
right.
Darby's tag champ. It shouldn't be, like, Freebird rules. That would be some variation of Freebird rules. But, I think it makes more sense for a tournament, and Darby enters a tournament with his new partner. Maybe you give him a bye in the first round, or they don't have to, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many titles in AEW. It's not in the lineage. Mm-hmm. Isn't perfect. I'm fine with whatever they're doing. If somehow the Bucks win, and I don't think they will. I mean, you just got to have Sting.
Yeah. It's,
with
yeah.
Cream. So, as for what's next for the Bucks, I mean, I don't know. They'll be obnoxious and they'll feud with, I mean, whatever. Who are the other top babyface tag teams that wouldn't feel like a rerun? You know, they should already be working on that.
Yeah, because, you know, we've seen them with FTR before, even though they left that thread hanging back in October with FTR. Mm. But again, that seems like a lifetime ago. Babyface tag teams. Boy, you got my head spinning too, and it's crazy because 4 years ago that this tag team division was so deep. You know, and my wheels are spinning. There's
not, other than FTR.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't want to see Bucks and FTR again. I want to see fresh opponents, and I want to see the Bucks elevate some people. So they got some work to do. But yeah, I don't have a good answer for that. Anything else you want to bring up from tonight's Dynamite? We've pushed past the 90-minute mark. I don't want to leave anything behind, but we don't have to keep going. I mean, I thought the Moxley Danielson Claudio FTR Kingston match was good. You know, it was a banger for 22 minutes. I don't know what emotion I have other than maybe frustration. I'm not despondent. That's like way overstating it. But when I see Moxley come out to his music with Danielson and Claudio in their heels, and Danielson's acting like a jerk, and they show a clip of him, you know, low blowing Jun Akiyama. It's just like, what are we doing here? People want to cheer Bryan Danielson. He's on his final stretch as a wrestler. Moxley isn't even a heel. He just happens to be friends with Danielson and Claudio, and they're doing heel stuff. I talked with Jason about it, and I've said it in other contexts. I think Bryan Danielson's being super selfish in wanting to be a heel because it's more fun. It's like, you're not in the business to have – well, I guess that's the – as I said with Jason yesterday on the flagship, it is the terms of him signing with AEW. He wanted to have fun, but I'm not going to pretend it's not selfish. He should be doing what makes the most sense to help AEW draw money, and being a heel with a babyface Moxley and a – you know, sort of tweener Claudio. It's so counterproductive and it's not helpful. And AEW needs all the help they can get right now to grow. But it was a heck of a match. And, you know, Danielson and Eddie, I think they've done a good job building it up with the asterisk being Danielson shouldn't be a heel. And I don't buy that he's a bad dude. And he's just cosplaying a heel with a half grin because he enjoys being a heel more than a face. And that is not the reason to play a role on television if there's competing reasons to do something else.
Yeah, what I was hoping would come out of this was ultimately Danielson wins this title and he finally, at the same time, Eddie finally gets that respect that he had never gotten from Danielson at the end. And Danielson will carry this title to the end of his full-time AEW run, drops the title at Wembley or maybe even All Out. You know, and that way he can go on this winning streak until the end and then finally put over someone that's worth putting over for that Continental Crown. I would love to see that happen. I don't know. Tonight led me to believe that that's not the direction they're going. I was hoping they were going that direction. The one thing that did rub me a little bit weirdly tonight, and I'm glad you brought up if there was anything else, the last 2-3 weeks, we did see a little bit more of a dedication to the women's division. There were a couple they were putting a couple segments on each show. Tonight, we got one segment. I still don't know with the Stokely Hathaway, Willow, Chris Statlander triangle is all about. Even though I feel like I watch enough AEW television that I should know, but I don't watch Ring of Honor, which I don't know if they feel like you mentioned it. Like, is this extended universe that I feel like I have to watch? And I know they said that we're going to hear something on Collision and that mad rambling, but there was no type of build on their flagship show for the Women's World title match that seemingly over the last 3 or 4 weeks, they've done a decent job of promoting this match. And then tonight they really didn't mention it at all, except for a couple graphics in the bottom left-hand corner. And it may have gotten mentioned during the rambling at the end, but again, I got so lost that I kind of zoned out.
And I mean, I know they've got a couple shows to go. I think based on Excalibur's frenetic, confusing plug, but you know, Tony Storm and Diana Perrazzo didn't get, to go home show for a pay-per-view. And we have the Willow Statlander Stokely Hathaway thing going on. I didn't mind, Stokely offering a chain and Statlander saying no and Willow saying don't do it and all that. And I'm not in any rush for the payoff here. I think the pace is fine. I was okay with what they did tonight, but yeah, I mean, when you're trying to sell a pay-per-view, you have a 2-hour show and you want everything to have space to breathe, I'm fine with not just wedging in women's segments for the sake of it. But
yeah. I guess if I'm going to clarify, like, I had no problem. I actually thought that match wasn't bad. It was a fine match, and I'm good with even seeing where this goes. I'm not one of those that says get this off my TV, but if I'm the one like writing the show or booking the show, I'm focusing on, this is my flagship show that gets 800,000 to 950,000 viewers weekly, as opposed to Collision. I'm pushing this, the world title angle on my most watched show, and I'm putting this on Collision. It's just, I just didn't understand the lack of push for a world title match on your highest watched show, and it was just weird to me.
Yeah, I agree. That was the last thing I was going to bring up anyway, is the women's match, and just talk about that a little. So you beat me to it, and that's good. Anything else you want to sneak in before we sign off, Tony?
I think we covered it all. I love coming on these shows with you. If you want to follow me on social media, basically all the regular popular ones that I'm public on is at Tony D'Onofrio, at TonyDonofrio. Basically all the main ones, X/Twitter, Threads. Those are the two that most people seem to be on. And like I said, it's always a pleasure coming on. Love talking to wrestling with you. And it's good to finally get to talk AEW with you.
Yes, it's been a blast. Thank you, Tony. Thanks to everybody who listens and our caller and email input on tonight's show. We'll talk to you Friday night after SmackDown. You're invited to join us there. You can always find a link to the live stream in my TV reports at pwtorch.com. And then VIP members, I'll be by Sunday night covering AEW Revolution free on pwtorch.com, and then doing the post-event roundtable for VIP members. Greg Parks will be live with Wrestling Night in America Sunday night covering the event, so you can listen to the live stream. We'll have a link to that in my pay-per-view report Sunday night.